Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, we'll preview the new Xbox consoles. Plus, Colin Baker explains why we should buy refurbished laptops rather than shiny new ones. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. And they are the best ways to get in touch with the show if you want a product recommendation as well. As I mentioned there, we will be talking about refurbished laptops, very much with a back to school, back to college focus. So do get in touch if you want a specific recommendation. But I'm joined once again by John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net, because at long last we have info about the new Xbox devices. John, what do we know?
Yeah, finally, I think Microsoft had to bend to the leaks and officially announce the pricing for both their kind of flagship next gen console and the more kind of consumer friendly or pricing friendly €300 console. So over the last few days, there's been a lot of tweets flying around from the official Xbox accounts online stating the pricing and the availability for these two consoles coming on November 10th. So we have €499 for their kind of beast of a machine, the Xbox Series X, and then the newly announced unveiled Xbox Series S. So a bit of a tongue twister to get those names correct, but this is the more price friendly €299 for this device, and this one has no disc drive, so you won't be able to play any physical discs in this new 299 device.
Yeah, I was looking at it when they pushed the tweets, and they pushed it quite a lot once it was all confirmed. And I prefer the look of the cheaper one, and I think in theory, if I were to buy one, that might be the one that I'd go for, the one without the disc drive, because, you know, even last week we were talking at home about buying a new game for the PS4, and we said, you know, should we go to the shop or will we just buy it online? And we ended up buying it online.
Yeah, and it's getting a lot of love online, just giving its nice, it's meant to be Microsoft's smallest console ever made, basically. So it's going to have a very small footprint, so it's not going to take up too much space on your TV unit or wherever you're looking to put it. But the one issue, unfortunately, people are flagging is that the bigger console, the Series X, has a terabyte of storage built in. But this all-digital model, the Series S, only has 512 gigs of storage, which is worrying some people, because we know even with titles that are coming out at the end of this current generation, clocking in at over 100 gigs in size. So you're looking at maybe maximum five large AAA games that you can store at any given time on this digital-only device. So there will be...
But am I right, though, in saying that if you complete a game, so if I have four games and I want to download another, I can remove one game and then just re-download it if I wanted to play it in a few months or a few years?
Absolutely. And like for the likes of us kind of with really respectable broadband in our homes, that really shouldn't be that big of an issue. But for others that don't have speeds, like the cities, like certain, like Dublin and the kind of the major hubs would have, that could be a real pain if you're looking to go, oh, I really like to get stuck back into that game from last year. And you're looking at, as I said, up to 100 gigabytes to download. That could take God knows how many hours on slower connections. So it's just something people need to weigh up when they are looking to purchase. But what I was going to say is that Microsoft did announce these kind of proprietary memory cards, very old school almost, like the old PS2 days, that you can buy. They're 1 terabyte in size. Now, their pricing hasn't been confirmed, but this will allow you to basically triple the size of this all-digital model with this 1 terabyte size. So that is an option for people that really like to have all their games on the console, more so than just the 512 gigs will allow on the €299.
Yeah, I'm very excited by the S model, I have to say, from a size point of view and the functionality. And I guess, like with these things, you do have to compromise somewhere along the line. So that's the disk drive thing. Do we know much about the accessories that go alongside the consoles?
Well, they've been very kind of open in the last couple of weeks in the lead up to both of these consoles. And they're quite proud in stating, and rightfully so, that current kind of peripheries or peripheral devices and accessories like the controllers, like the even the fancier, the Elite controllers, the kind of the more expensive ones, and even the adaptive controller that was for kind of people with limited mobility will all work across both the current gen and the new gen. So even if you buy a controller, one of the new controllers for the new console, you will be able to still use that new controller on the current consoles. So there's a lot of interconnectivity, which is good for the consumer. So you're not going to be kind of played out of the market, for want of a better term, if you do upgrade. You can use your current controller on the new Xbox if you like it more than the new controller that will come with the console, if that makes sense. So it's very kind of consumer friendly in that front, that you can kind of jump between both consoles with both controllers in a way.
Yeah, it's funny. This is a conversation we've been having at home. We were only talking the other day about, you know, what consoles, if we were to buy the new Xbox, what console would we get rid of to make way for a new one? Can you still do trade-ins and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm currently looking at the different websites now. Obviously, GameStop and Smiths and even Argos have kind of these, put in your kind of inquiry now on this website, or even GameStop themselves are saying for people to inquire in store to see what options are available. There is no kind of, I haven't personally seen any lists of kind of what price you'll get for your current PlayStation if you were to trade it in against, say, the new Xbox. But I imagine with all the details only having been revealed in the last couple of days, that we're going to start getting more offers coming from the big brands that say, look, if you've got an old Xbox and you know you're going to upgrade to the new one, we'll give you this or so much for us to kind of go against the new title. And with the likes of stores like CEX across the country, they usually give pretty respectable trade-in prices. So you could get your cash there to use then towards the new console when it launches on the 10th of November. But I guess one point to note with the price points of these two new Xboxes, the 299 version, the Series S, will kind of have a bit of a kind of a lesser power, say. So you won't be getting your full 4K 60 frames a second next gen experience. That this device is kind of more so for the bedroom TV, or for kids that don't really care about 4K or don't have it hooked up to a 4K television, that you're not going to get the full-fledged kind of picture quality or clarity you'd expect from a next-gen console, per se, in comparison to the actual Series X model. So that's also where the price difference can kind of be equated to, the lesser power inside the device itself.
Ah, that's kind of disappointing, because you and I have spoken about this for some time over the last number of years. The quality of the games now, they are so immersive. I think it was Red Dead Redemption 2, and you feel like you're on the set of a movie. But if you're not going to get that 4K, and if you're someone who, you know, bought a TV, like I know a lot of people who bought a TV specifically for watching sport and gaming, that kind of is a bit of a game changer.
Well, they have stated kind of 4K upscaling technology that, you know, for many of the laymen, they kind of, it's negligible if you can see it in terms of how far you sit away from your TV. Something as ridiculous as that, if you're kind of far away from your 4K telly, and this new console, this 299 console, the Series S, is upscaling to 4K from a resolution of 1440p, which is kind of sits between full HD and 4K. So it's kind of like a middle ground somewhat. And then the console then will do a bit of heavy lifting to upscale so the image of the game. But again, if you want the full native 4K resolution with 60 frames per second or even 120 frames per second, just the best picture quality possible on an Xbox for next gen, you're going to have to go for the Series X model, the more expensive model.
Okay, so is that the one that you'd go for?
Yeah, because I've been a kind of an advocate of the when the Xbox One X came out, which was kind of touting its own 4K capabilities and was matching those capabilities. I was quick to kind of jump on the bandwagon and get that hooked up to my TV. And like you said, with the games like Red Dead Redemption, which runs at a native 4K on the current Xbox One X, it looks stunning. So having a 4K TV, I know I'll want to have the best picture quality possible with the next gen console. So I would be aiming for the Series X. But with the Series S, I'm obviously more of a niche kind of audience than general consumers, because there will be many, many families and kids and anyone really that will be looking more so at the Series S, given its price point and given that they may not be hooking up to 65-inch or 55-inch 4K tellies in their homes, that it's more than acceptable. People will not be able to tell the difference once they hook up and put them side by side in a way.
And I know that some people will be hoping to put this on their wish list for Santa. Do we think that he will have enough to go around?
Yeah, I think Santa has been working hard for the whole year, even with everything that's been going on. So I'd imagine there shouldn't be any issues with kids that kind of are really kind of Xbox fans and are kind of dying to get the next console, that he shouldn't have any kind of demand issues. He should be well able and stocked up for the Christmas period.
Okay, and do we, and actually I know the answer to this question before I ask it, but do we have any update from PlayStation on the PS5?
We do not, unfortunately. Mm. I guess the ball is, every single ball now in the next-gen game is in PlayStation's court. So, as I said, all we know is that there is two models, and what differentiates PlayStation's two models to Xbox, to Xbox's both models is that we know that the PlayStation models are the exact same spec. The only difference is the disc drive isn't in one of the models. So you're going to get the exact same experience, the full 4K, 60 frames, 120 frames, even 8K they've been touting, kind of, but that's down the line when games are going to be able to output in 8K. You're going to get both specs in both models, just one won't have a disc drive. So people are speculating, like I said before, the price points to be $399 for the discless one and $499 for the disc-based one, but that's still TBC.
Actually, another gaming question that just popped into my brain. Have you tried the new Tony Hawk game? Because there was so much buzz about that over the last few weeks.
I haven't, but there's been some seriously positive feedback. I was a big Tony Hawk fan back in the day on the PlayStation 1, back playing the originals like a lot of people. And I see that they've done an amazing job of of remastering it for the 21st century, basically. And it's just launched in the last 2 weeks, I think. And it looks visually stunning, and it's been to be very... respectful to the original titles, and fans of the original are more than happy with what they've done here. Some people do poo-poo the idea of remasters. They'd rather a whole new title rather than it just being a kind of a prettied up version of an older game. But this game is a icon. It's a cult classic that people are more than happy to play again. So it's really good to see it getting the scores it's getting on the different gaming websites.
Yeah, in relation to the throwback games and the remastering thing, I don't really like, in music, for example, when albums are remastered. But it is something different with games because there's the nostalgia element, your muscle memory kicks in. Like, I remember when we got the Nintendo Switch and all of a sudden I was able to play Mario Kart again. And it's a much better experience playing on today's consoles with today's quality of games versus, going back to the GameCube or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. And I think in terms of gaming in general, you mentioned like remastering music, they remaster movies, and you can get 4K copy. But I think for gaming as a genre, it's the best kind of showcase of what remastering can be, that these games are being completely made from the ground up to look as visually stunning as possible. So they kind of, yes, they have the same name, but in terms of the appearance, it's night and day. Like there's just no comparison going from a PlayStation 1 kind of version of the game to the PlayStation 4 title of Tony Hawk. Like you say, albums, and it can only sound so clear or so good per se when they remaster it. But with a game, they can completely, from the absolute ground up and make it look visually incredible. So the remastering really suits this type of industry.
Yeah, I went back to Forza 4 a few weeks back, and I do think it's one of the most stunning and most enjoyable games. And this may sound silly, but I'll say it anyway. One of the reasons I don't like games like Red Dead Redemption 2 is because the story stresses me out. Like in Forza 4, you can just lose yourself. You sit behind a car and you play away, and you can spend your time in a game without having the bejesus scared out of you.
Yeah, well, there's no baddies. There's no one shooting at you. There's no jump scares, like you said. It's just get in the car, listen to some really good tunes, and race from point A to point B as fast as you can while taking in the scenery. It's a very nice turn your brain off and just relax and enjoy the view, basically.
Is there another version of that game on the way, or how often do they come out? I remember you were at the launch of Forza 4. Was that last year?
That was 2018, if my memory recalls. So we're 2 years since the most recent Forza Horizon. But there has been an announcement. They did announce a couple of months ago that the studio behind these titles is currently working on a remaster. Again, we speak of remasters, or kind of more so a reimagining of one of Xbox's most famous titles from back in the day called Fable. This is kind of almost like, I want to say, Lord of the Rings-esque kind of English countryside mythological fantasy game. That mm-hmm. The studio that makes the Forza games is actually currently, but that's not to say they don't have two teams. So rumor is that the next Forza is coming, but it hasn't been announced yet, and it'll be based in Japan. But that's a very, very vague or very non-confirmed rumor. But because as we remember, the 2018 edition was based in the UK itself, or across Great Britain. So the rumor is it could be Japan, but there's been nothing confirmed since the last title has come out back in 2018. So fingers crossed we get some news soon.
Are there any titles you're excited for, or you know, how do the title announcements work when there's a new console or consoles coming?
It's been absolute Wild West territory. Like, as just with everything that's been going on, the fact there was no big gaming conventions, be it Gamescom or E3 in the US, game developers and kind of publishers have been kind of going out at their own whim, kind of going, mm-hmm. Right, we're going to launch this game. Like, even with the fact that there's going to be cross-generational titles. So, for example, the new Watch Dogs game, it's kind of like a hacking game made by Ubisoft. That will be launching October 29th on the Xbox One and the PS4. But then, what is it, 12 days later, the new Xbox consoles are launching, and it'll launch for that console as well, be it with upgraded graphics, upgraded visuals. So, but if you did buy it on the Xbox One, and then you end up buying an Xbox Series S, Ubisoft will allow you to upgrade to the new version of the game for free, which is a really good kind of consumer-friendly thing. So there's a lot of this, who's doing it for free, who isn't, who's giving you the kind of the upgraded version, and who's charging. So there's a lot of back and over of what kind of who's being friendlier to consumers or not. But there is launch titles for these new consoles. Like, there's a new Spider-Man game set to launch with the new PlayStation 5 this year. Halo, unfortunately, like I said previously, a brand new Halo title, Halo Infinite, was meant to launch with these new Xbox consoles in November, but unfortunately it got delayed till next year. So Xbox is trying to show off all of its other kind of third-party titles that will be available on the PlayStation 5, but also will look spectacular on the new Xboxes also. So it's kind of up to the consumer what version of the game they want to play or what console they want to play it on.
So should people hang on or hold off on buying new titles until they decide what console they're going to buy? Because I know myself, I'm fed up having a wall rack full of old console games that can't be used on newer models.
Yeah, see, that it's a case of, for the first time, well, with the Xbox, anyways, with these new consoles, that there, you do have a bit of breathing room. There's nothing that's going to make you go, I have to get these new consoles immediately to play these titles, because a lot of the big games that are launching this Christmas will be launching on the current gens anyway. So you don't feel like you have to be forced into upgrading to the new Xboxes anyway. But with the PlayStation, as I said, the Spider-Man game will only be launching on the new PlayStation 5. So if you are a Spider-Man fanatic and you want to play the newest one, which is still lined up to launch, there's rumors it could be delayed to next year, but nothing's been confirmed. But if you do want to play it, you will have to buy a new PlayStation 5 to play it. So it's really down to personal preference, what you want to play, or how long, if you can wait it out a bit.
Okay, well, as soon as we get our hands on the new consoles, we will bring you our reviews. But if there are any titles that you want us to try out and review, email techtalk@newstalk.com. John, before I let you go, we have even more new devices from Huawei.
Yes, so just yesterday they had their developer conference, their kind of big, massive Huawei developer conference, and they launched a lot of consumer devices not related to their smartphones. So we've got new earbuds, we've got new smartwatches and new laptops. So I guess starting with the earbuds, there was the earbuds, their take on the AirPods Pro, and they're called the FreeBuds Pro. Mm-hmm. And these are lovely little black, well, the version I'm testing at the moment are little black ones that have active noise cancellation, which all premium earbuds kind of need to have these days for cutting out the background noise. You've got nearly 5 hours battery life. They charge wirelessly. I've been using them for a few days now, and I'm very impressed so far. And they're going to be €179 when they come to market at the end of the month.
The FreeBuds are brilliant. They are probably the closest looking ones to the AirPods, but obviously a fraction of the price. I've recommended them to so many people, even people here in the office who now love them. And it's great to see the new versions coming out, because not everybody is a fan of the size of the Samsung ones, for example. I had Emmett Ryan on the show a few weeks back, and we were talking about the Huawei P40 Pro and the P40. That's the Google-less phone. And I have not been shy, I suppose, in expressing my frustration with the device. Even though it has an incredible spec on paper, I just didn't have a great user experience. How did you find it?
Yeah, like as I said, I was more than happy to kind of tinker with the back end to get the apps I'm so used to, just to make it work for me, because the camera is so good, because I'm such a fanatic for taking smartphone photography or taking photos with my phone when I'm out and about and just making them look as good as I can, that I always want to make sure I have it to hand. So I wanted to get my all the apps I'm used to onto the device. So it took a bit of tinkering, as I said, but it's not as much of a pain as I actually thought it would be.
Yeah, but John, do you think that the average consumer who have bought Huawei devices in the past will be able to move on at ease with the new operating system?
Yes, but the operating system will, in terms of kind of usability and functionality, it's similar to what they're used to with Android. But it's the fact that they don't have direct access to the app store for the apps they're used to. That's definitely going to be a hurdle for many that don't feel comfortable going on to kind of third party, say, outlets or kind of third party app stores, even via Huawei's own app store, downloading the apps that they usually use every day. And, you know, the biggest, you know, exclusion being the Google apps that are just very difficult to kind of get working properly on these devices if you don't know what you're doing. So it is, it would definitely be a bit intimidating for someone that doesn't know exactly how to get the latest version of the app onto the device from Google software or from Google's platform.
All right, I'm going to go back to it one more time and see how I get on, because the camera is incredible. The battery is incredible. I just couldn't get my head around the new operating system, but we shall see how we go. For now, John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jess.
Coming up next, to refurb or not to refurb.
So it is, it would definitely be a bit intimidating for someone that doesn't know exactly how to get the latest version of the app onto the device from Google software or from Google's platform.
All right, I'm going to go back to it one more time and see how I get on, because the camera is incredible. The battery is incredible. I just couldn't get my head around the new operating system, but we shall see how we go. For now, John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jess.
Coming up next, to refurb or not to refurb.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. And we're going to turn our attention now to the issue of child safety online. CyberSafe Ireland is an organisation that released the results of a survey earlier this week that showed how children are faring in the online space. And one of the headlines that gained quite a bit of attention focused in on the number of children talking to strangers online. And we're going to talk through some of the results now. And I'm delighted to be joined by Philip Arneil of CyberSafe Ireland. Philip, welcome back to the show. We were talking through some of the findings of the latest CyberSafe Ireland survey during the week on the hard shoulder and across different programmes here on News Talk. And I was really interested with some of the findings. Before we talk through it, I suppose the ones that jumped out at me were the fact that 90% or more than 90% of 8 to 12-year-olds surveyed have a device of their own. But I was also encouraged by the fact that more than 50% of that age group went to parents when something went awry online. What's your overall sense of the findings of this survey?
Well, I think there's a couple of things probably worth commenting on there. I think the 93% of kids that age from 8 to 12 who have a smart device, I think it's probably worth clarifying that actually tablets and games consoles are the two most popular types of devices. And I think when we talk a lot about this, and particularly when we're interacting with parents, often the focus tends to be, and even in schools perhaps as well, tends to be around smartphones. But what we're finding actually is that until kids are about 11 or 12, the more popular devices are tablets and games consoles. So it's just worth putting that into some sort of context initially. I think as well, it's right to say, you know, it's encouraging that parents are being approached by their kids when something happens online. And I think that sort of really underlines our message. If it was to sum it up in sort of one sentence, is it's really important that parents and kids are talking to each other and really sharing what they're doing online. And I think when things do go wrong, or kids come across harmful content or contact or whatever happens online, as it inevitably will, those channels of communication are open and they feel comfortable and able to bring those things to their parents. I think I noticed yesterday you were talking on News Talk as well, and I was pleased that you also drew attention to some of the more positive aspects of the things that we'd found as well. We know that 84% of the kids that we surveyed are actually talking to people about what happens online, whether that's parents or trusted adults. And actually 87% we found had some kind of rules around online usage at home as well. So, you know, we think it's really important to balance the positive sides of technology and the empowerment that that brings as well. And it's really encouraging for us as an organization to see that not only are there some perhaps more worrying statistics, but actually there are really positive developments on that front as well.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to have you on, and people may remember I spoke to you during the lockdown about kids' use online and what parents can do. But the reason I wanted to have you on this time around is because sometimes when surveys like this come out, people will hone in on one stat, one worrying stat, and the conversation can go down the road of, oh, sure, it's a done deal now. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. Technology is here and it's ruining everyone's lives. Whereas I want to have a more considered conversation, because the last time we spoke, yes, we spoke about the scary side, but we also talked about the brilliant things that technology can bring into the lives of children and the way it can connect families and friends. And I want to make sure that we do have that balance. And I know that that's something you guys are wary of as well. So in terms of practicalities, if parents read those statistics during the week or heard them here on News Talk, what are some practical tips and what's some practical advice that parents can implement to try and turn the tide if they are worried that things have gone down a little bit too far down the road, or if a parent is thinking about starting on sort of the digital journey with their child?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really fair point, and it's great to hear you talking about that balance. I mean, I think I may have used it before, but if we take the analogy of cars, you know, there are car accidents every day all around the world, that nobody ever suggests getting rid of cars. And, you know, equally with technology, it's there. And as you've said, particularly in lockdown, we've seen perhaps how powerful and transformative it can be. You know, there's millions of kids have been able to attend some form of schooling and get some form of education because of that technology that's now available, in addition to obviously being connected with families in different cities or countries and communicating and collaborating with friends as well. I think, you know, just to sort of touch perhaps on one of the statistics that you may be referring to, which obviously inevitably the media being the media, they tend to perhaps pick up on slightly more negative statistics, was this the talk of maybe kids, 61% of kids had been contacted by a stranger online. And by no means are we saying as an organization that that's some sort of nefarious activity. Of course, we know that a lot of multiplayer games online, the very nature of them is that you're playing with a range of people. And of course, you don't know those people offline. But I suppose the question that we would want to pose is, if you don't know who those people are, is it worth asking a few more questions and delving a little bit deeper? Because obviously, if your children are talking to people that they don't know, there are potentially risks there. And particularly with the number of kids that are playing over 18 games, you can probably logically assume perhaps that a lot of those players are also adults themselves. And so I think, you know, in terms of giving parental advice, what we would say is, initially, of course, as I've said already, keep that communication going. And I think more than that, what parents really want to do is to normalize discussion about the online world. Make it an everyday part of your discussion with your children, in the same way that you would ask them, you know, how did they get on at school? Or, you know, how did the match go? Or what did they get up to at the club? And so on and so forth. And then I think beyond that, then, you know, delving a little bit deeper, you know, what are the more popular apps and platforms that your particular children are using? What are they talking about at school? And then using various online resources like CyberSafe Ireland, there's WebWise, there's Common Sense Media, all these resources are there. And very quickly, I think those things can demystify just exactly what the games and apps that are popular are. And then beyond that, I suppose within those particular games and apps, it's just worth maybe discussing some rules and some norms with children. So, you know, are you allowed to accept followers, for example, that you don't know in the offline world? If you are gaming, you know, are you just gaming against the computer? Or indeed, are you gaming with people that you don't know in the offline world? And then, you know, if you are gaming with people that you don't know online, you know, are you able to chat and message them privately? You know, is there any kind of facility within those games and platforms to send images and videos and so on? And I think, you know, the more that online life discussion becomes a norm within the home, I think it's going to be much easier to mitigate the potential risks and dangers that, you know, do exist. And there's no sense in ignoring those, albeit that there is a lot of positive aspects of having this technology, whether it's for communication, collaboration, or just fun and entertainment.
There's another conversation that I want to come back to, and it was on Wednesday's Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan, and a parent emailed Andrea and said, I have two kids, 8 years old, and it was either 10 or 11 years old, and they were kind of pleading to get access to TikTok, and the mother was wondering what the right thing to do was. And some really, you know, interesting callers dialed into the show, texters came into the show, saying, you know, I have my 11-year-old on TikTok, but it's under my name and I control the account. There was other parents who were absolutely against it. We know that you need to be 13 years of age to have an account. And also the age of digital consent in this country is 16. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very easy for me as a non-parent to spout off those facts. But when you're faced with a pleading 8 and 10 or 11-year-old, it's a very different conversation to try and have. So what's the advice in that scenario?
Well, again, you know, I think what we're looking at is the modern version of, you know, I want those trainers, everyone else has those trainers, or everyone has this football kit, or I want to buy this album, or whatever it might be. And so I think, you know, there's nothing particularly new about that. You know, kids are always want to be included, they want to be part of the group, whatever the popular thing is. You know, we get this question a lot from parents, and unfortunately, I suppose, we can't give that answer that I think a lot of parents want, which is this kind of silver bullet solution. You know, we say, well, when kids are this age, you know, they should get this. And when they're this age, they can join that. You know, to go back to your comment about the age, you know, certainly I would say that's a starting point. And it's not so much perhaps that kids shouldn't be on there, but it's that, you know, a lot of these platforms are designed for young people who are 13 and over. So, you know, again, to use an analogy in a different arena, you know, would you allow your children to go to the cinema and see a film that was rated 4 or 5 years for young people 4 or 5 years older than your own child? And oftentimes I would say the parents will say no. So perhaps you can also apply, you know, that analogy to allowing them online to things like TikTok as well. But certainly if you do get worn down and you do get ground down by your children, and in the end, you just want a little bit of peace and quiet, and that's the decision that you make. I think then within that context, it's really important to A, make sure, of course, that you're monitoring that account. You know, it being in your name is very sensible as well. Making sure you always have access to that device that it's being accessed on. And then, of course, within the app itself, you know, making sure that the settings of the account are private, that there's no facility to be private messaging or chatting with people that they don't know online. And I think a lot of it also depends very much on your own relationship with your children. And of course, you know, the child itself, you know, as a teacher of 20 years, I know there's a very wide range of 8-year-olds, and there's certain 8-year-olds you can maybe do some things with and others that you couldn't. And so I think you've really, parents have got to, as best they can, make that decision within the context of their own family. But in addition to that, really inform themselves about what the apps do, what the possibilities are, and then, of course, what the sort of potential risks and harms can be if they are going to eventually grant access to that below the minimum age.
We are at the start of the new school year, and fingers crossed we make the whole way through it with COVID. But I am fully aware and fully prepared for the fact that, you know, over the coming weeks and months, sadly, we will have more discussions about cyberbullying and about things going wrong online. Overall, how do you think we as a society are equipped to deal with the new issues and the ongoing issues? Because cyberbullying is just bullying in a different format, I suppose. But do you think that we are equipped, and that parents, and, you know, I don't have kids, but I have nieces and nephews who I'm very, very close to. And so if something goes wrong, I want to be involved in those conversations as well. So do you think that we as a society are equipped to deal with these things any better than we were, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
Wow, that's a tough question. possibly, yes, in the sense that perhaps we're more familiar now with the technology that we have. And I think probably one of the side effects, and again, this is purely an opinion, but I think perhaps one of the side effects of the last few months has certainly been, you know, I know from talking with colleagues, even ex-teaching colleagues, that, you know, a lot of teachers, for example, have been forced to really adapt to the use of technology and embrace that perhaps much more than they would have done if they had the option of being in a physical classroom. And again, I suppose that extends to the home as well. I know even just from my own experience doing things like Zoom quizzes with my parents over the lockdown, which perhaps was unthinkable maybe, 5-6 months ago. I think in terms of things like cyberbullying, we have seen an increase. I know in the US, certainly NCMEC reported that there'd been 106% increase in child exploitation behavior online, based on the tips that they've received through their helpline. And so I think it's an inevitable effect of us all being online more, that this kind of behavior, unfortunately, is going to increase. And I suppose that extends also to things like bullying. Particularly if kids are at home, they're not able to do what they normally do. They're probably going to go or gravitate online. And, kids being kids can obviously get bored, and perhaps, these things can start, or they're more likely to continue at a greater pace. In terms of whether we're more equipped for it, I would say perhaps no, because obviously in the sense that these things are continuing and we do realise that this is an ongoing problem. But certainly I think having these discussions like we're doing now and making it aware, making parents and teachers aware of certainly the incidence of this kind of behaviour, the symptoms to look out for, and then strategies to deal with it more effectively is definitely a really good first step towards better coping with these kind of problems that come from spending exponentially more time online.
Absolutely. Well, look, there is a brilliant parental portal up on cybersafeireland.org. If you are a parent that's looking for information, it's a good starting place. But as I said on the Hard Shoulder with Kieran the other day, if you are unsure about something, reach out to one of these organisations, reach out to us, and the information is out there. I often get emails from parents saying they feel powerless about this kind of stuff, but that doesn't need to be the case. So if you want any advice, cybersafeireland.org is a good starting place. Philip Barneil, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Jess. Great to talk to you again. Take care.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Many questions have come in over the last number of weeks about the best device to buy for a student in school or college. While I often recommend new devices, one man is encouraging us to look at refurbished devices. I sat down with him on Thursday afternoon to discuss.
I'm Colin Baker. I'm head of Back from the Future. We're a chain of computer repair stores and IT providers. We also look after IT for schools, colleges, businesses, and all manner of people and places.
So Colin, we're at the back to school, back to college time of year, and a lot of people have been texting and emailing into this show, into the Pat Kenny show, looking for device recommendations. And while it's quite easy to open up one of the big tech store websites and find a device that's there, sometimes it can be quite expensive, sometimes it can be not quite what they're looking for. And so a refurbished model is something to consider. Before we talk through the refurbished process, what's the difference between a refurbished device and a second-hand device?
Okay, they're about as far apart as new and second-hand. So second-hand is typically stores around that would buy items off customers, check that they work, and then resell them. Now, there's really no heritage there. There's no guarantees there. There's no surety that this thing is going to work for into the future. And typically what you're dealing with is retail machines that really only have a single life. One of my hobby horses is that a lot of the cheaper retail models that we see coming out now, and by that I mean store bought, supermarket bought, sub €500 laptops, say, that look shiny, they're pink or they're blue or they're silver or they're multicolored or whatever, and they look great on a catalog, but ultimately the consumer is bamboozled by, oh, that's got a terabyte drive, or that one has an SSD, what's an SSD? And there's no real expertise to guide them in terms of what they need. So they're making false comparisons in a lot of cases. And I what I would say to people is anything new in a laptop under €600 that I've seen on the general consumer marketplace just isn't worth buying.
But that's a frustrating thing to hear, I suppose, if you're someone who is contemplating or has just bought a device in a store for less than €600, because a lot of people don't want to spend more than that on a device. A lot of people want to get something new boxed up and presented as a gift or as a treat to themselves. So is there any of those devices that you would rank, or do you have to spend about a grand on a device to get a new one that is worth owning?
Yeah, well, I'd certainly say Mac hardware is awesome hardware, but again, you're ramping up the numbers to telephone figures, and you just got to break out the big guns for those. You've got like the best machines in the world, to my mind, from a pure technical point of view, in terms of taking them apart, servicing and maintaining them, and seeing what's out there and what comes back to you and what problems arise, is Lenovo ThinkPads. They're those black, garish, utilitarian-looking machines that sell for 1,300 euro plus VAT to corporates and to industrial users, not available in stores. That brings me to our point about refurbished models. Refurbished laptops, factories do not refurbish retail machines. So cheaper machines that only have a 2 or 3 year life expectancy, which by the way is not something that I like at all about the industry. Mm-hmm. Equipment like that should last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, not 2 or 3 years. That's what we're seeing with a lot of the cheaper new equipment. Industrial or commercial laptops, that is your ThinkPads, your Dell Latitudes, your HP Pros, these machines that are to the consumer eye not necessarily very attractive. They can't necessarily access them. When they do look for them, they're quite costly. They are built to last a lot longer. Better components, better engineering, and better support as well, better parts. Now, beyond that, when they are 2 years on in corporates, corporates are perfectly happy to expire them, send them back to the factory. And what's happened in recent years is people like Lenovo have been compelled by social pressure, really, to look at ways of giving those that equipment a new lease of life and giving it back into an ethical purchase channel, if you like, that can be supported, that can still retain that level of decent support for the end user. Now, that's schools, colleges, medical centres. That's where they're looking to get them. And they're getting them, they're bringing them out at a much cheaper price. So the factories are effectively taking them after 18 months or 2 years with a corporate. They're reinstalling, they're putting in new batteries in some cases, new drives in most cases, and they're grading them so that you're getting exactly what you're meant to get. And they're being sent out as, in a lot of ways, virtually new systems. But instead of 1,500 euro, they're 400 and 500 euro in some cases, even cheaper in some cases, depending on the grade. But the advantage to the consumer at the end of the day is if you are prepared to buy something on the basis of strength and robustness and reliability, you're making that conscientious decision to make to buy something not because it's pink, not because it's a particular color, or not because it has a shiny box with it. I mean, we are, as consumers, consuming vastly too much technology, vastly too quickly. And it is as a result of big brands saying, here's a new one, here, you need a new one, 2 years on, 18 months on. They want us buying stuff, new stuff. They want us being appealed to by the shiny new box and that lovely smell and experience as you open the new product. But if we can be a little bit more conscientious about it, you get better quality, much higher performance machines. Now we're talking 3, 4, 5 times higher performance, more connections, connectivity and features, better webcams, better audio, better graphics. So we're getting better equipment that'll last longer. And generally, if you buy from the right frontline, so in other words, a decent store, a decent provider, a recommendation that you've had from someone in the know, just that you are getting that right advice. And back to your point about schools and colleges, one of my pet peeves, and I see it every year, in the next few months, you'll see people, schools, students, parents coming in with laptops they bought for the 299, and they didn't realize that that 32 gig onboard drive would fill up in about a month. And suddenly the thing's not working, they're bringing it back to big supermarkets, they don't know how to help and support them, and it's costing them a lot more than the difference between the 299 and having bought a sort of a decent discerning machine back in the day. And so we see a lot of that, and they're having to spend money and time and stress trying to get these problems sorted. Actually buying right rather than necessarily buying cheap is usually, ironically, the most cost-effective way to go.
So with some of the like the Lenovo devices that you mentioned there, and I know that this is something you're very passionate about, so do you get your hands on some of those old commercial machines and you refurbish them, set them up for the college student, for someone like myself who wants to work from home, that type of thing? Yeah. And you and your team go through and ensure that it's right and will work and it's not run down and the processor still works and it's still pacey and all that kind of stuff. You have a checklist essentially of it making sure it'll do the job.
Actually, it's more comprehensive than that. It's done at factory level. So there's warranty centres around Europe who are charged by Lenovo, and they are Lenovo warranty centres. They're where the Lenovos go back to be sorted and fixed and whatever. And they go back to them. They actually do the refurbishment process.
Okay.
When they come in here to us, and we deal with all those centres around Europe, and we pick and choose the best, we cherry pick from them. And then when they arrive here, we set them up with the software. So we set them up, they've already been licensed for Windows 10 Professional, so it's much better than Windows 10 Home, so again, as an advantage. We set them up as well so that you don't have this bloatware and malware and adware that you tend to get with a lot of new retail machines. There's no trial versions. Mm-hmm. We put on what people need, which is Google Chrome, built-in antivirus, built-in anti-spyware, Zoom is pre-installed, Skype is pre-installed. None of this is running in the background, so it's a rarefied, purified form of Windows so that you turn it on when you get it home, you connect it to your Wi-Fi, and for vast majority of people, that's it, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing to be registered, set up, sign in here, tell us what you like for breakfast, it's ready to go. So actually most of the refurbishment is gone. It goes on at almost factory level.
Mm-hmm.
And that testing and threshold testing is ironically, and this is another thing that people don't realize, it's more extensive than on new equipment. New equipment gets very, very rarefied testing at the end of the production line. Refurbishment processes have four times more testing that goes on. So the result is that in most cases, we would have a lower fault report with refurbished stuff than we would with new stuff. And that's the irony of it. So if you can make that conscientious decision and buy through, well, the likes of ourselves, I'll be honest, or there's lots of other people like us out there, then you are going to get better product with a better backup and service behind it and with a better experience for a longer time.
Does it come with the warranty and the usual bits and pieces should something go wrong within the first year or 2 years?
Well, that's another nice thing that I was alluding to. What actually happens in warranty centres when you buy new stuff is that when you say buy from a supermarket and you have a warranty, when you go to reclaim that warranty and something happens in 3 months and the screen doesn't light up, you have a phone number to ring. Those centres are typically not in Ireland. In fact, none of the major brands have a centre in Ireland, so they're off in the UK. So you've got a time taken to book that return, to have them collect it, to have it go to the UK, to have it be dealt with over there and booked for return again, either to the shop or directly to yourself. So it's a very long, drawn-out process. With refurbished warranties, Lenovo, in our case, support us. So they give us the backhaul of parts. So we have, at all times, in the lab here in Dublin and in all our branches, a constant supply there on the shelf of parts, lest something should happen under warranty, or even if just somebody happens to smash it, or drop it down the stairs, or pour wine all over it, as so frequently happens.
Yes, indeed. And so, what kind of money are we talking about? Because the amount of time and effort that have gone into these devices, the spec that they have, if they're as good as that you're making them out to be, are they still going to cost us an arm and a leg?
No, I mean, you're talking pricing, including VAT, starting at $349 all in. So the prices aren't particularly high. And then you can creep, but that's a decent sit-at-home machine. It's perfectly portable, decent battery life, solid state. We don't do old-fashioned spinning hard drives anymore. So we only do solid state. So that machine will start in 14 seconds. It'll probably outperform most of the machines that you'll buy on a supermarket shelf for less than €600. And that, you know, it'll be perfectly decent. Now you can scale up from there. The machine I love to use, I've always loved to use, is called an X series. It's a 12.5-inch size machine, two batteries, so you got 10 to 14 hours of battery life. You still have lots of USBs, two or three display ports. Like, you've everything on it. You've three microphones on it. You can deflect bullets with it. The old joke with these things is, if you do happen to get attacked while you're out in public transport and out and about doing some work on your X series, you can beat them off with the X series and then go back to work. Those start around $499. So again, even the really, really high-end machines that I would, you know, pick from the entire range of what's available to me are only starting around €500. So there's very good value to be had. But what is close to my heart is this idea that we are tricked by a lot of the industries into wanting that new pink or blue or shiny experience, and we're tricked into buying machines that just look good in a catalogue or purport to come with some free antivirus or free 6 months. It is a form of trickery, and it ends up with people buying new stuff far too frequently, costing far too much, and then ultimately, not that I'm I'm some sort of massive environmentalist, but ultimately the technology waste pile globally is the most enormous and complex to deal with. Mm-hmm. And if we can make conscientious decisions that serve us well and end up getting us decent equipment, then why not? It does serve the environment.
Yeah, I think the environment point is one that will push people my age and younger to buy a refurbished device rather than a new one, because we are so aware of how long it takes the plastics to degrade, what happens to the batteries, what happens to all the parts. And the thing that I have found, even though I am a tech journalist and it's my job to move phones and review phones and all the rest, even the packaging that comes with new devices, it does just feel a bit too much. I think that's the point that will stop people, more so even than the cost differentiator. I think a lot of people are now more, that they're thinking green more often. What about devices that we may already have at home? You know, what if we've fallen into that trap, as you described it a few years ago? We bought a device, it wasn't up to scratch then, it's been sitting in a drawer since. Is there anything that can be done with that?
Totally. Look, ultimately the worst case scenario is that it does get driven through recycling, the Irish programme, which isn't terrible. Mm-hmm. It gets put in bins, it gets distributed to centres, it gets put on ships. At the moment, a lot of it's going to Africa, and then they pick through and go through the waste there and pull out the parts that are most toxic and get rid of them the right way, or reuse minerals and parts of the metallurgy that can be reused. So there is a level of recycling there. The best form of recycling ultimately is upcycling as much as possible. Now, what we do here, it's not something we shout about because it's not done for promotional reasons. When people drop in laptops or equipment here that we can make use of, we will do our very best to do so, because the very best form of recycling is to put that back into use. So we'll often make machines, we put machines together for St. Vincent de Paul so that they can either resell them or give them to somebody so that they do get another 2 years or 3 years out of that life. You mentioned about someone having a laptop at home that's doing nothing and it's old hat. They can be refurbished. They can be tidied up. We had a lady in yesterday with an 8-year-old Dell, and it owed her nothing, but we stuck in a solid state drive, bit more RAM, reinstalled Windows 10, and she loves the machine, and I think it cost her £200 or something like that. I think we got her a new battery as well, and she's sitting pretty for another 4 or 5 years with that machine. So you can upcycle for yourself, or you can just drop it in. Thankfully, most tech stores are now compelled to be part of the Wii program. So you are entitled to go into Power City or PC World with old equipment and say, there you go. They're obliged then to pass that through to the right places to get them properly recycled or sent off.
Obviously, we've been talking about laptops. What's the story with phones? Because a lot of people will get on to us saying that, you know, they have bought a new phone and they either smashed the screen or, you know, poured wine in the charger port accidentally. Yeah. And it can be almost as expensive as buying a new phone to get the screen fixed. Mm. Are you seeing issues on that side of things at all?
Yeah. What we find in the industry is a couple of main points. iPhones and smartphones, when they come out initially, the parts are massively expensive. They just are. And if you actually try to buy the phone itself, you look at, say, an iPhone 11 Pro Plus, like they're €1,500 retail, unattached to any network. So it's a lot of equipment you're dealing with, a lot of technology. And so the screens, when people hear that it's €500 or €600 for the screen, that sounds nonsensical. It's kind of worth it at that point. That's what you're buying. You're buying into a very expensive paradigm of equipment, and the parts are that expensive, and then you're paying for someone to fit it as well. So it can be expensive. If you want to be more economical about it, I always say, stay just behind the wave. Don't have the very latest iPhone. If you don't need the very latest iPhone, my mother doesn't need it. She's a great WhatsApper. She loves taking photos, but she doesn't really need the latest. So she's got an iPhone 8. It's just behind the wave. I think she bought the latest refurbished one for about 399 or 350 or something like that. if she breaks the screen, it'll be maybe 120 or 100 euro for her to solve. So stay just behind the wave. They're still current, and you can buy refurbished versions of those as well. But repairing is nearly always still better than just throwing it out and replacing it, for the environment and for your pocket. But also, figuring out yourself, shopping around, if you do break something. In some cases, we talked about this before, you love taking things apart.
Yes, I do, yeah.
And okay, it doesn't always work, and sometimes you'll snarl yourself into a bigger mess. But what I always say, I appreciate when people try that. There's plenty of YouTube help out there and parts you can buy online to give it a shot yourself. Don't put, yes, I mean, it's broken already. How much more damage can you do? And usually, if you still want it repaired and you've managed to mess it up, you can come to people like ourselves and say, look, hands up, I've tried this. We appreciate that. We respect that. We learnt by making mistakes. And there was no college course for this. Mm-hmm. So we learnt by pulling things apart when I was a kid and getting in trouble and breaking things and trying to put them back together again before my parents found out. That's how we learnt, and it's a great way to learn.
That was Colin Baker of Back from the Future. And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Pocket Casts, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Friday's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.